Good afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we talk with writer Da Chen. His second volume of memoir is just out. Sounds of the River follows the publication 2 years ago of Colors of the Mountain. That critically praised book was about growing up in the Chinese countryside during the Cultural Revolution. Da Chen grew up in the tiny village of Yellowstone in southern China in the 1960s and 1970s. Colors of the Mountain ends with Chen boarding a bus to begin a trip to Beijing. He's 16, going on 17. He's been admitted to the prestigious Beijing Language Institute. His father lovingly hands him pears through the window of the bus for the long trip. At the outset of Sounds of the River, readers find Da Chen beginning the second leg of his trip. He's on his own, boarding a train for the long ride to the big city. This is the beginning of a journey that ultimately takes him to America. Da Chen is a graduate of Columbia University Law School. He's a brush calligrapher and plays the classical bamboo flute. He lives with his wife and children in the Hudson Valley of New York. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Da Chen. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana. The number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Da Chen's new book, Sounds of the River, is published by HarperCollins. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Mr. Chen, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. It's
How
good
are
to be
you?
On your show.
Oh, it's nice to talk with you.
Thank you.
Both books, Sounds of the River and Colors of the Mountain, open with an epigraph that features a couplet your grandfather was very fond of. Would you share it with us and talk about its significance?
Right. My grandfather, you know, see, I have written two memoirs, and the people ask me why you wrote them. And I said that really, as I now sit here and reflect on it, it's really about one word, love. And it is the love that has been given me, and it is the love that I ought to be given those who love me. And I borrowed these two titles, Colors of the Mountain and Sounds of the River, were both from couplets that my grandfather had written, painted on the front door of our old mansion back home in China. And on the one side, it says, Colors of the Mountain will never leave our door. And on the other, Sounds of the River will linger forever in our ears. Grandfather was a poet, and he was prone to writing line verses like, I will drink the sea and eat the mountain. But in this case, nature captures him. These two couplets not only captures the beauty, the scenery in front of our old house, but to me, it also captures the essence, the soul of China. Because China is all about sounds and colors and the rivers and mountains, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want my grandfather's trace, his legacy, to go on the pages of my books.
These books are very much a tribute to your family. You say that they're about love. Indeed, they are. Your family, very close. Is that typical of Chinese families?
Well, it is in my family. And usually, family ties are the things that bind people together in China. There's a phrase in Chinese culture called 四世同堂. Four generations living under one roof, same roof. And that phrase is there to mean that the family has been living in harmony and the family is prosperous. The family has a wonderful seed growing. It's an essence of harmony. But the thing is, when I was in one of the signings, one of the Chinese, my fellow Chinese person came up to me and said that, I want to thank you for expressing love in such a way through your books, because even though Chinese people are very family-oriented, they don't express love the same way that Westerners do. They don't hug each other. They don't talk about it as much. It's a sort of silent and a very mute kind of love. but it is powerful, and it is what holds everything together, like any culture, I believe.
Mm. I'm reminded of a story you tell in Sounds of the River of your brother who is very fond of a girl, but he can't quite bring himself to express his feelings. and he thinks he's invited her home, when in fact he's only hinted through a friend, no less.
Right.
Yeah.
That brings to mind the phrase "love tortures." My brother, it is. People are very. I don't know if people know anything about Japanese culture. It's quite similar to some extent that we are awkward when we express the most tender and intimate feelings. And the amazing thing about my family is that my parents, my mother is the most loving, and my father is very big with hugging.
Mm-hmm.
He's like a little emperor in this little house. And that's why when he passed away, I mean, that void still mm-hmm. lives on in me. And but nonetheless, he was so big that I always tell people that even though my parents gave me my life but for me to keep, but I have been living for them ever since. And that is how big my parents are to me. And now that I have children, I begin to feel that I'm sort of equally divided between living for my parents and living for my kids now. And I become smaller and smaller and smaller and insignificant.
Mm-hmm. Four generations under one roof.
Right. And that's a symbol of happiness, harmony, and everything else.
Mm.
四世同堂. Mm. It's a phrase. It's a title of a very famous book as well. It's a symbol of good things.
Tell us something about your mother.
My mother came here to attend my wedding and stayed on. Tells nobody about it. But anyway, we grew up in a very poor, tiny little town, and people who have not read Colors of Mountain would like to know that I actually grew up in a little town called Yellowstone, deep south of China. And to visualize where I came from, just to imagine China to be in the shape of a chicken or a rooster with a chest facing the Pacific Ocean, that is actually the shape of Chinese map. Peking will be somewhere near the neck, Shanghai somewhere near the chest, and Fujian province, where I came from, is near the belly button. And you don't want to know where Hong Kong is.
I never thought of a chicken with a belly button.
Right. Exactly. Interesting. I was in Kansas City, and it was this gentleman, Walt Modine, a legendary radio host, asked me. Well, I told him this story, and he said, well, by the way, I grew up on a farm. Chickens have no belly button. I said, well, I just invented one. So that's where I came from. And it was not by nature, it was not by tradition poor, but it was rendered poor because of the Cultural Revolution. I grew up during the late 60s, early 70s, and that coincided with the disastrous period in Chinese culture called Cultural Revolution. And Cultural Revolution was something, a sort of political movement cooked up by Chairman Mao Zedong. And there was nothing revolutionary about that Cultural Revolution. It actually, the Cultural Revolution brought, I always call it cultural ruin, because it brought China to the brink of bankruptcy and everything. Millions died innocently. My fate was even worse than them, because I was born into a family of former landowners. And as you know, private ownership was contrary to every belief that communism, belief that anyone who had ever owned anything automatically became the enemy of the people, and for the sin of owning something. So when I, Chinese little boys, we all believe in fate. In fact, interesting thing about things in a country, each baby is born. The moment they were born, they will be their fortune will be told by some really wise man in the village. And so we all believe innocently, you know, believe in our fate. But the fate that I saw at that time as a little boy was seeing my grandfather getting beaten up all the time in the street. And I have personally, I couldn't understand why my grandfather, what a nice, loving, dwindled man at that time he was. But he was treated so badly, like animal, as if he was sort of a limping dog, a crippled dog that happened to be walking across the street, and people would be rocking at them as if it was something to be done with. And I have personally witnessed my father getting hung by both thumbs to the ceiling by the communist cadre. And what really puzzled me was that, these were the men who were just the most loving and towering figures in my family. And once they stepped outside the family, they became sort of like animal. Nobody cared for them. Nobody had any sympathy for them. Everybody said that they were bad guys, while they were really not bad guys. So it was so unnerving and very scary to see your father reduced to tears many times because he was beaten and he was crying like a baby. And I think I became a man just seeing that happen to my father.
Mm. How did the family manage during those years?
And that brings back to the mother, the subject of my mother. And mother was left alone because my two men, my grandfather, my father, were sent. Again, everybody lives under the same roof. And they were sent to the camps. And they would be gone for 6 months. And my mother was the only one left to take care of five siblings and my grandmother, who was also dying. And the time was tough, and so was the food. We ate what we grew, and sometimes we grew very little. We had Fujian province was very prone to having typhoon, which was very much like hurricanes. And once these guys come, they'll wipe out the whole season's harvest. And there were seasons, there were months that we would only resort to eating. My mother was very creative. We couldn't afford to eat rice, so we would eat moldy yams. Yams, you know, sweet potatoes. Mm-hmm. But when we couldn't afford moldy yams, mother would go to the market and buy those moldy yams and cut away the moldy parts. And I'll tell you, even the good part still tastes bitter. And if you keep them a little longer, the little green sprout begin to grow from those little yams, from little yams. And we used to joke about it. We say, well, now you get both yams and vegetable at the same time. And that's how we handle. Mm-hmm. And mother was always very worried. She's a petite woman. She has a very strong heart. But you know, with men gone, all those kids around, and each time she worried, and she worried a lot, loudly so, we began to worry. And I think that is why to this day, you know, my wife, who is a Chinese lady born in America, always asks me, why do you worry so much? Mm-hmm. And I think that worrying streak came from mm-hmm. that childhood spent mm-hmm. worrying.
Mm-hmm. My grandmother was an orphan and came from Ireland. And boy, when we would go to visit her, she'd pile the food on our plates. And I think it was to make sure that we would never go through what she had experienced.
Right. Food. Wow.
Yeah.
My mother does the same thing. She now lives with us. And we try, and she takes, it's not even her duty, but she takes this feeding our baby so seriously, you know. She'll chase after them with a bowl of rice. And at one point, actually, our daughter got so plump, pleasantly plump.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And then we have to sort of talk to her about, you know, there's a point about dieting, you know, that you don't want to get a baby's too. I mean, we don't want to say that this is a bad thing, but we don't, because that will make her feel really bad, mm-hmm. you know. She'll say, why, how can it be bad? Babies need to eat all mm-hmm. the time if you can afford to feed them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think now she realized that, you know, babies doesn't have to be so plump, you know.
Yeah, you can have too much of a good thing.
I know. And And that is unnerving to her too. Like, wow, no, you're not worrying about why aren't you eating? You know, so it is ironic. But food was heaven to her. Even to this day, you don't want to waste one grain of rice in front of my mother. She still considered that sort of anti-nature because rice was so hard to have, so hard to grow. You know, from this little of pillow of a seed, eventually grow into hundreds of little pillows of dreams. That is why if you see some pictures, if you have some pictures of visiting Asia, you will see this in front of each rice field. You will see a little statue of Buddha or a little statue of Earth God watching these rice grow, because humans feel so utterly vulnerable in nature. You could put in your work, you could sweat, and you can stay up at night, up all night to work on the land. But then after all, you have to pray so that the rain will come, the typhoon will not take away our grains. And it's a tough life. No wonder we cherish food, because it's so hard to come by.
Writer Da Chen is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of three books, China's Sun, Colors of the Mountain, and Sounds of the River. Sounds of the River is his latest. Colors of the Mountain and Sounds of the River are memoir. And the first book that he wrote, a memoir, Colors of the Mountain, told the story about growing up in the Chinese countryside during the Cultural Revolution. The new book, Sounds of the River, is about going to Beijing to study English at university. And it's the beginning of a journey that ultimately takes Da Chen to America. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. In Champaign-Urbana, the telephone number 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. At the end of Colors of the Mountain, you say, "Goodbye, Yellowstone. I am forever your son, and I love you, Dad. I am your son forever." What was it like leaving Yellowstone for Beijing that first time you left?
Well, actually, just by hearing you mention these lines, it almost brought tears to my eyes.
It's a very moving.
Yeah, you know, when I was writing the last line, I still remember doing that. It was putting down, typing in the last word. It was very much to thank my father. My father had passed away already then. And to leave Yellowstone, I couldn't even, anyone who had ever left their hometown that they love very much would only understand. Only people who had done that would understand. And I left with an extremely mixed feeling of, you know, loving this place and hating this place. And that little place is like a little pearl of dew, morning dew, that contains everything there. Most importantly, love. That is almost air to me growing up, the love from my family. And I have never been outside the territories of this little county. And this county is very odd in a sense. It has its own dialect, has its own customs, ancient dialects. Just recently, I found out some linguist told me that some of the pronunciations of that dialects that we use in Putian County dated back to year 680, Tang Dynasty. The phrase is like the word me, I, is gua. And gua is actually the phrase used by the emperor then. That is how old. Everything was sort of frozen in there. And I like talking about that because some of the reviewers said that, you know, there are other Chinese writers out here who write bitterly about China and all that. But Da Chen writes from the soil of China with exuberance of life and possibilities. I'm actually quoting Lisa Si from LA Times quote. And some people said that Da Chen's approach, just Da Chen's China, is narcotically entrancing. Even though I assure you there are no narcotics involved. And someone else said that, oh, his prose is so soaring, you know, and I, you know, all those things really sent me soaring. But when I was leaving my Yellowstone, it was a tiny little town of 1,000 farmers, peasants, who were destined to this prehistoric farming forever. My father plowed the field with the water buffalo. I, growing up, each time you need a drink of water, you have to go fetch the water from the old well. There was a well there somewhere near the edge of the village, and you have to go there and pour the water, fetch the water with bucket, and hold them up and carry them home and boil them with the fuels, which doesn't, you don't turn on the stove. The fuels is the wood that we chopped in the mountains and then carry back and then dry them. And, you know, everything is so very complicated. And I was leaving this little town, not leaving this town to go to fulfill a wonderful dream, to go to college. It was, there was not even comparison to do that to in American society at this point. For the comparison, for me, this shoeless, muddy little village boy to be given an opportunity to study quote-unquote English, very, very prestigious major, in Beijing, one of the best liberal arts universities in China. I always compare that to the following story, to this, that I always see myself as a little frog sitting at the bottom of a dry well, deep dry well, daydreaming. This is a very dreamy little frog and hopeful. And every day he sits on the bottom of the well and looking at the gleams of the sky coming through the little mouth of that well, and he worships that little sky of his. He worships anything that flies by, the clouds, occasional drops of rains, and of course he admires the beautiful birds that fly by. And one day, a very, very beautiful swan flies by, and the little frog, that is me, points at that swan and says, "I love to have that one," and it falls onto my lap. And that is how unlikely the opportunity was for me to go to college to do all that. And that came not just through my hard work to study day and night, you know, which was the studying part, the going to college part was captured in last part of Colors of Mountain. But it was also through a lot of sacrifices from my family, my parents, my sisters worked so very hard, and my parents had to borrow food, money to buy food so that we can study. We can not farming, do the farming, but study. And we study without electricity, with lamp. And we literally got electricity about a week before the examinations came. And those examinations were brutal, studying with big mosquitoes and everything. And eventually to have that dream hand over to your hand and say, "Da, you are not ready to go." And all those, I felt this weight of ancients of years of labor and hard work and dreams on my back, leaving the little town, taking the first train ride to ride for 50 hours, 3 days basically, to go to Beijing.
A listener is waiting to talk with us. Let's go and talk with this caller waiting for us in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm ignorant and a little confused. If your family had a mansion and were landowners at one point, and then you said you felt horrible to see your father, your grandfather going out and have no one have any concern for him or care for him.
Right.
Is that not equivalent to people in this country who go out and feel because they are poor that no one has any concern and care for them? If you could reflect on that.
Well, it has to do with the twisting history at that particular moment. We were the landowners, and then suddenly communists came, and they began to put migrants, took our land, took our house, took our storefronts, and make us the enemy. That was the twist in between. We were respected country landowners, and all of a sudden we are the worthless enemy, the sort of, they call them politically black family. And that was what was done. And part of this book was really there to tell the story about this historical period in China where many, many innocent people were tortured. And I write from the voice of a young boy to tell the stories of that happened to my family, not as a political book, but as a sort of personal memoir, just to share. And it's a story about survival. It's a story about love from the family. It's a story about hope in the place of no hope.
I understand. And then the other question is, I thought that the universities were free, and so that the work involved of your family is their work to have to survive, but that you were able to go to the university, I assume, because you were bright, and then it's not something you had to pay for.
Correct. That was why. That makes the dream even sweeter, that when I eventually was able to leave that little village to go to a paid-for university with the promise of a government job. It was so very sweet.
I see.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call this afternoon. Da Chen is our guest this afternoon. When you arrive in Beijing, what was it like stepping off the train and making your way through the city?
Well, I was... this second book, Sons of River, is the universal scene, a theme of a small country boy meeting the big city. You know, the seduction, the dazzling aspects of the city, all the dreams and everything. But once I arrived in Beijing, there were so many things that I was not used to. First of all, when I was living in a little town, I didn't even know what they ate there in the northern part of China. And China was so, there was no communications between among each part. So I was traveling, say, in a map of Europe, I would be traveling from the southern part of Spain all the way to live in Helsinki, you know, somewhere in Scandinavian. And there was the terrain changed, climate changed, everything changes so very much that you don't even eat the same food, you don't speak the same dialect at all. So, but the biggest shock for me was the country versus city shock. That the concept of the idea of having a weekend really, really bothered me. For the first few weeks, I really did not know what weekends were for, because my father would never say, well, this is Sunday, I have to sleep late, I can't plow the field. And my mother would never say, oh, this is Saturday afternoon, I don't want to do the washing and all that. And all of a sudden, there's this wonderful thing called weekend, Saturday afternoon, everybody drops everything, goes shopping and cook a nice dinner for the family. And I was always debating between inside myself, should I work or should I not work? Should I go with city flow or should I just go work very hard like my peasants and the farmers do, which is keep on working and working and working. And I think eventually I chose the latter. I chose to study during these weekends and all that, study very hard. And that gave me even a worse name as a sort of a country boy.
Mm-hmm.
There were, of course, other things, but, you know, that was, I think, was the biggest shock. And I was also shocked that they were really, city people were a lot lazier than I was. I was really there not only to work for myself, but I carried this dream in my head. I was working also for my parents, those who I left behind. And I was... And then the concept of telephones, and, you know, I was so very miserable as well. And I would write letters, and the letters will take a month to arrive to my parents' house in Fujian. It's just very miserable, you know. And and it was moments like that that you realize the power of their love, my parents' love for me. I dream about them. However few letters my father wrote me, I always, you know, hid my letters, those letters under my pillows, and whenever I miss them so very terribly, I would read them with tears in my eyes, you know. But you know what? After half year of staying in Beijing, I got over it. And from then on, I told my father, I could go anywhere, still love you, you guys still love me, and I can't, I'm not homesick anymore.
You tell a story in Sounds of the River about writing a composition for a teacher, the beautiful Madame Rose.
Right.
And you describe it, this story, as being about, quote, my muddy town, my provincial grandma, and my huge appetite. And you worked so hard at it, but you were so unhappy with it. But You earned an A.
Right.
And it seems to me you're very, at this point in your life, you're torn between the love you feel for your family and how you miss your little town, but at the same time, you're struggling with, oh, I'm such a hick. My background is so provincial.
Right. I think that I have been struggling ever since I was born. You know, I loved my family, and I was sort of ashamed of my family at the same time because of sort of political blemish. And I, up to the point where I went to Columbia University, and all those things begin to undo itself by the time I started writing about Colors of the Mountain. I started writing these memoirs. And then I begin to tell myself, what a foolish feeling to have, that this is actually some of the most important, most beautiful feelings, most genuine emotions that I was had been in possession with in. And writing about this wonderful village that I grew up in and writing about this wonderful family makes those shame go away. Columbia University is kind of place where you don't talk about poverty. You talk about trust funds and that sort of thing. When I arrived there, I think I learned my first lesson about the city place where people really show off is my classmates always wore very nice ties, and one day I showed up with a nice tie also, and my friends say, where did you get it? I said, well, in Chinatown somewhere, and the peddler saw me, and I say, it only cost me $3. My classmate said that, that's cheap, da. Mine cost $80. But the ties are almost the same. As it turned out, you know, theirs were made in Italy, and mine was made in Little Italy. but you know, you don't talk about lack of trust funds. So then you grow older, and all those things became much more meaningful to you. The inner China, that beautiful little village that is in me, become bigger and bigger, and all those guys who loved you, those people who had helped you along the way, become giants in your memory. And it was then that I decided that it is time to write about them, to remember them. The only way to honor them, those who are dead, my grandfather, my father, my grandmother, is to remember them and let people know about them. And ever since Colors of the Mountain has been published, it was translated into 6 languages. Only the other day I received some original copies of Colors of the Mountain in Greek. I tell you, I could never read one word in it.
Is it in Chinese?
It is in Greek.
I know, but has the book been translated into Chinese?
Not in Chinese, not in Japanese, but most of the European countries.
Huh.
Interesting. And there are people who can wrote, hundreds of people who wrote me and to praise my mother, calling my mother a perfect mother, calling my father a strong, beautiful man, and calling my grandfather the most, most endearing old man. And you know what? I'm happy with that, and I'm content with that. I say to myself, I redeemed myself in their love, with their love as well, because they give me my life, but I give them, I'm quoting a cliche here, I give them immortality.
Have you returned to China since coming to the U.S.?
I have done that a couple of times.
Uh-huh.
The last time was about four years ago, and I returned as Mr. Chen. You know, it was so phony. You know, you left as a poor boy, you know, just going out to, you know, for a dream somewhere in America. And the moment you arrived back, I was working for a New York law firm called Skadden Arps in Beijing. They sent me there as a sort of representative, and people began to call me. I stayed in the probably one of the best hotels there. They called me Mr. Chen, this and that. And when I asked the hotel staff whether they have a Chinese restaurant within this hotel, the man turned around and said, with much disgust, no, we don't have a Chinese restaurant. So But he said, we do have Italian restaurant, American restaurant. And you know what? Next day I checked out and I moved into an apartment. got myself a bicycle, and I was riding around in a heated, very hot summer Beijing, wearing Western suits, you know, delivering exorbitant legal Manhattan legal services that I don't think they needed there anyway. That was my experience there.
Yeah. You know, at the Language Institute, I was surprised to learn at the differences in the quality of life of the Chinese students and the foreign students in terms of the food and showers and you name it.
It is outrageous. I mean, as much as, foreigners and foreign tourists like to be treated special, Chinese governments are more than happy to do that, put them in a different category. And there is that... the college that I went to, Beijing Languages Institute, was the first one in China to open to foreign students. At that time, China was opening up in early 80s, and they realized there were more people coming to China, so they decided to open one college up for foreign students. And that's why that college had about two-thirds of the students were from foreign countries, and only one-third from China. And we were there mainly because they need some Chinese students to commingle, to sort of give them a reality of China so that we can be friends with them. The authorities did not encourage us to be friends with them, but they encouraged them to sort of have a superficial cultural exchange, to give them the samples of be a good Chinese people to these guys, okay? And we were sort of sampling dumplings. And that's why it's very, very ironic to throw me, someone like that, who came from a sort of a very ancient little part of China, and put them right in the middle of this campus where I said that was filled with white people, black people, green people, yellow people, people with blue hair, yellow hair, and all sort of thing. And for the first few days, I was living in this unreality of reality, dreamland. And it was... Shock was hardly the word. It was an out-of-body experience, very much so. I mean, yeah. you can, for the first time, you begin to look at them and say, whoa, they are really white people. Their hair is yellow, blonde, you know, and eyes are really blue. And it was just beautifully, you know, wonderful black people from African, and there's Middle Eastern people. There is other people from South America and everywhere. I was thrown into this painting that has many, many colors, and I call myself little banana, you know, the yellow one. That is why, you know, I always said that, you know, I've been so fortunate to be sort of one of these guys who's given this exotic journey in life, and now I'm in America. My first stop was in Lincoln, Nebraska, and then to New York. Every step of the way has been blessed by God, and wonderful journey. And I cherish all that. The other day taped by C-SPAN Book 2, which they played last weekend. I think they're going to be playing again this weekend. And after the tape was played, Monday, our publicist got a phone call from Joan Rivers. She said, I want to interview this man because I saw him on C-SPAN 2, Book 2, C-SPAN 2, Book TV. And on that program, I spoke for 50 minutes. And she said that I have to interview this man because he's so, you know, wonderful and everything. Experiences like this, it just, you know, was wonderful for me. And one thing that she asked me about was, do you think American Dream is still alive? And I said, yes. That I am living an American dream here. And I said that the reason is because America is the most generous nation in this world and in the world history as well. It is, to me, you know, especially in today's, you know, climate, I say that this is still the final frontier, the final sanctuary in every sense of every religion in this world, that people should come here and be good to America and make it a better place. before and pay your dues, pay your tithes before you could be blessed. Mm. And as a new immigrant, I'm proud to say that I am a new American, and I'm proud to say that this is still the greatest country on earth. Be nice to us, you know.
What's it been like for your mother? How does she, when she looks around at life in the United States? We talked earlier about how she wants, she chases after your kids with, you know, with food, you know, come
right.
on, eat. And here we are, so wealthy, well, many of us are.
Right.
And yet we throw so much away. And how has she adjusted to life here?
She doesn't speak English, but just to use one example, I think she has progressed in some way. A few years ago, if any flight attendant on the plane asked her, "What, ma'am, what would you like to drink?" She would say, "Tea." And then they began diligently adding cream and sugar and everything and hand it over to her, and she drank it and she shook her head. That's not tea. And nowadays, if you ask her, "What would you like to drink?" she would say, "Black tea."
Black tea. Mm.
So in her small way, she's adjusting, mm-hmm. and she's making progress, one word at a time.
Mm.
And I think she's enjoying her time here very much.
Mm.
And my children, her grandkids brought her a lot, still bringing her a lot of joy, and that helps her recover from the depression that she suffered greatly after the loss of my father.
Yeah. I don't know, just to think of, you know, to think of you and Joan Rivers and your mother all together within a few minutes of time.
I was having an out-of-body experience, too, when I was interviewed in Denver by her, and she was the sweetest, the most wonderful, and very basically good people. You could feel that. The reason why she wanted to talk to me is because I talk about goodness. I talk about love. I talk about this wonderful family that I ought to honor and wonderful people that I honor. And I think that's universal, and I think that brings out the best in everybody. And that's what I'm the most concerned about.
Mm. The friends that you made at the university in Beijing, mm. have you kept in touch?
Well, many have emailed me to ask me whether they are in the book. And the funny thing is, you know, as much as all those negative things they've done to me, these people who sort of, you know, made fun of me, make a mockery out of me, didn't really realize what they did. they didn't realize. I was a monkey in a class, and they decided that should be victim. Each time there's a joke to be had, that start with that guy. And I was that guy always, and I lived with that, and I wasn't happy about it, but I didn't fight back in some way or any way. And, you know, I was just, and people really do not careful in things they do. But I came out as a better person because I realized how hard it could hurt someone from the outside, and I couldn't bear to see mm. anyone doing that to another person in front of me nowadays, you know.
Mm.
That's what I gained from them, you know, from that experience.
Mm-hmm.
So, But life goes on, and, you know, the best part about remembering your past is that only the good things becomes even better, and these negative things really are not that very important. They become a sort of sad backdrop. Mm-hmm. They fade away,
mm-hmm.
and the prominence, wonderful things become more prominent. They become mm-hmm. landmarks and milestones,
mm-hmm.
and that's what we honor, mm-hmm. and that's what we remember.
Yeah, I imagine that before you sat down to write these books, that you never thought about that dance of chopsticks at a family meal as being, you know, so special.
Right.
Yeah.
No, many things actually begin to have a meaning once you really begin to sit down, because we lived our lives so carelessly, so hurriedly, that we never really sit down to figure out from why do I take a journey from point A to point B. Why did I do that? What compelled me to do that? And what is the undercurrent of that period? And those are the things that became very clear when you begin to dive into that river of memories and swim and to take in the nutrients of the essence of life as you swim along. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you really, I think everybody can do that. You are able to sort of knit together a nice little net that will eventually catch that big fish.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you. It's been an honor for me.
Da Chen, the best to you and your family.
Thank you.
Da Chen has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Look for his books, Colors of the Mountain and the new one, Sounds of the River.